Welcome to Health and You at Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Lynn Boyer, your volunteer reader. Today I have a couple of articles I'd like to start with from the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The first is a statement by FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb, MD, on Baxter manufacturing recovery in Puerto Rico. It's dated October 13, 2017. Since Hurricanes Irma and Maria devastated the island of Puerto Rico, the FDA has been working closely with Baxter and other companies to reduce the risk of shortages of critically important drugs and to minimize impact on any existing shortages. In particular, Baxter and the FDA have closely monitored and identified ways to prevent a significant shortfall of production of Baxter's sodium chloride 0.9% injection bags from its Puerto Rico facility. Also known as mini bags, this product is used to provide fluids and medications to patients across the U.S. While these products have been in shortage industry-wide since 2014, and other manufacturers exist, the agency and Baxter recognized that further shortage of this product could potentially put U.S. healthcare at risk. The FDA has worked closely with Baxter to find solutions to prevent additional shortages. Among the FDA's efforts to assist Baxter, the agency recently helped facilitate the import of these products from the firm's facilities in Ireland and Australia after the company lost several production days at its Puerto Rico facilities. The FDA has also taken many steps to help Baxter restore operations in its Puerto Rico facilities and move critical products onto and off the island. The FDA and Baxter will continue to keep in close consultation as we monitor the challenging situation on the island. The agency is also continuing its work with other manufacturers on steps to prevent or mitigate shortages of other types of critical medical products. Among the actions that the FDA is taking, in conjunction with other manufacturers and federal and local government partners, to help restore production in Puerto Rico and maintain operations on the island, is helping facilities secure fuel and manufacturing supplies, and the logistical support to move critical products onto and off the island. The FDA is also expediting reviews and approvals of other dosage forms and generic versions of products as alternate sources of critical products. Above all else, we at the FDA remain fully committed for the long run to the people of Puerto Rico to help them recover from this tragedy. And the second article, also from the FDA, is a statement by FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on medical device manufacturing recovery in Puerto Rico. This is dated October 20th, 2017. During the weeks since Hurricanes Irma and Maria devastated the infrastructure of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has joined federal and local agencies in the effort to help the people of Puerto Rico recover and begin to rebuild the island. Among the challenges the FDA has addressed is the potential for shortages of critical medical products. The FDA has been monitoring more than 40 drug products and working closely with dozens of pharmaceutical and medical device companies to help these important facilities get back online, enabling employees to return to work and manufacturers to ramp up production of medical products used by all Americans. I've spoken recently about the importance of the medical product manufacturing presence in Puerto Rico, both to the economic well-being of the island and to the health of all Americans. The FDA has provided information on the scope of drug manufacturing in Puerto Rico and our concerns around the potential for critical drug shortages resulting from impacts to these facilities. Unfortunately, the devastation caused by the hurricanes to Puerto Rico's medical product manufacturing sector goes beyond the effects on pharmaceutical companies. The FDA has been working equally hard to minimize shortages of medical devices manufactured in facilities on the island. There are currently more than 50 medical device manufacturing plants in Puerto Rico, employing about 18,000 people. Collectively, they manufacture more than 1,000 different kinds of medical devices. These include simple but essential products like surgical instruments and dental products, as well as highly complex devices such as cardiac pacemakers and insulin pumps. To date, we're monitoring about 50 types of medical devices manufactured in Puerto Rico that are critically important to patient care because they may be life-sustaining or life-supporting and/or because they may be the single manufacturer of that device type. The FDA is working closely with about 10 manufacturers, some of which are the sole manufacturer of a certain device type, to prevent medical device product shortages across the U.S. We are particularly focused on blood-related medical devices. Puerto Rico's device industry is facing the same basic but significant challenges as most manufacturing sectors in Puerto Rico: a lack of power, connectivity, transportation, and clean water. Most, if not all, of these medical device manufacturers continue to run on generator power and as a result have been unable to return to pre-hurricane production levels. In addition to these concerns, the medical device industry faces obstacles specific to the unique production requirements of each of these products. The device manufacturers have significant variation in the raw materials they require and the production processes they employ. These manufacturers face challenges in securing the various components critical to device development. These issues are exacerbated by the dependence on local subcontractors who provide much of the supplies needed for these unique manufacturing processes, but are facing their own challenges and shortages. This includes suppliers of components of a finished medical device or industrial gases, as well as tools that are critical to the production of devices. The FDA is working with device companies and their suppliers to restore production in Puerto Rico as quickly as possible. Similar to our efforts with drug manufacturers, we are also working, in conjunction with manufacturers and government partners, to help device facilities secure fuel and the logistical support to move critical products onto and off the island. Manufacturing on the island remains fragile, and the potential for device shortages persists. As we continue to monitor at-risk products, the FDA is taking other steps to mitigate the potential for shortages. This includes considering, when necessary, importing a device from outside of the U.S. or allowing manufacturers to shift production to alternative sites. We know it will likely be months before power is fully restored and medical product manufacturing returns to pre-hurricane levels. The FDA is committed to helping restore the medical product manufacturing in Puerto Rico as part of our efforts to protect the health of Americans and help the people of Puerto Rico recover their local economies and livelihoods. The FDA continues to stand with the people recovering from this devastating series of storms. The FDA's Chief Operating Officer and Associate Commissioner for Regulatory Affairs just returned from Puerto Rico, and I hope to return to the island again soon. At the FDA, we will continue to do all we can to aid in Puerto Rico's full recovery. The FDA, an agency within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, protects the public health by assuring the safety, effectiveness, and security of human and veterinary drugs, vaccines, and other biological products for human use and medical devices. The agency also is responsible for the safety and security of our nation's food supply, cosmetics, dietary supplements, products that give off electronic radiation, and for regulating tobacco products. And next, a statement from FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb, MD, on new steps to advance medical device innovation, and help patients gain faster access to beneficial technologies. This was released on October 24, 2017. Enabling patients and providers to have efficient access to new and innovative medical products that meet the FDA's gold standard for safety and effectiveness is a core part of our mission. We're advancing these goals as part of the Medical Innovation Access Plan that I announced earlier this year. While we've unveiled parts of that plan already, we'll be releasing its full details shortly. As one part of that effort, we're announcing some additional steps we're taking right now to promote beneficial medical device innovation. Medical device technology evolves quickly. The process for improving the performance and clinical characteristics of medical devices is highly iterative. Often, it's the case that small modifications help provide incremental but meaningful improvements to products. Over time, these cumulative advances are consolidated into more noticeable advances in the performances of different technologies. Therefore, it's important for the FDA to enable innovators to have the flexibility to efficiently make these kinds of small modifications. At the same time, the FDA needs to establish modern tools and benchmarks for measuring the safety and performance of devices to make sure they're delivering the expected benefits to patients. First, we've completed our first qualification of a medical device development tool, or MDDT, to provide a more objective platform for developing devices in a key area of medicine, cardiovascular health. Fostering the creation and validation of development tools that can be used to provide more efficient and accurate ways to measure risk and benefit as part of the medical product development process is a key goal of the FDA. At the FDA, we're undertaking a comprehensive policy effort to facilitate the development and validation of these kinds of medical device development tools. Today's newly qualified MDDT is a 23-item questionnaire that measures health information that is reported directly by patients with heart failure. The tool can be used to measure a heart failure patient's health status, including clinical symptoms and the physical and social limitations caused by this condition. Such a tool has the potential to help engineers designing heart failure devices to more efficiently and accurately quantify how much their device could actually improve a patient's quality of life. By qualifying the tool under the FDA's new voluntary program, it will make it easier for product developers to rely on the outputs of this newly qualified tool as part of their development plans. Innovators can trust in advance that the agency has already found the outputs of these measures to be reliable. We expect to evaluate and qualify more medical device development tools in the coming months, and we encourage this kind of product development. One area in which there may be an opportunity is wearable technologies. These tools have the potential to provide fundamentally better ways of measuring clinical outcomes, like how a device or even a drug affects outcomes that relate to physical performance or the function and output of different organ systems. The development of more modern tools for measuring outcomes relevant to regulatory decisions is a key part of our efforts to promote innovation. Such development tools can also help minimize the use of animal studies, reduce the duration of testing, or require fewer patients in a study by optimizing patient selection or by improving on the ability to measure benefit and risk through the availability of measurements that are more sensitive for assessing these outcomes. Today, FDA experts from the agency's Center for Devices and Radiological Health issued a blog on this important program. To make the development process more efficient and predictable, the FDA is also releasing three new guidance documents today related to medical devices. The first is a draft guidance delineating the FDA's new, quote-unquote, Breakthrough Devices Program, which was created by the 21st Century Cures Act, passed by Congress last year. Building on the Expedited Access Pathway, or EAP, program, this new program is intended to help patients more quickly access certain devices that more effectively diagnose or treat life-threatening or irreversibly debilitating diseases or conditions, such as technologies that have no alternative or that offer a significant advantage over FDA-cleared or approved alternatives. The program described in the draft guidance would enable a more agile pre-submission process for breakthrough devices. Breakthrough device innovations that are highly novel can also be more complex to assess. Thus, earlier and more frequent interaction between the FDA and manufacturers, as outlined in our draft guidance on the Breakthrough Device Program, should allow manufacturers to make the best use of their resources to bring state-of-the-art medical technologies to the market faster. Another two final guidances will help innovators determine when they need to submit a new 510K prior to making a change to a legally marketed device subject to pre-market notification requirements. These policies will help innovators introduce iterative improvements that can improve a product's safety and performance by establishing a brighter line regarding when the FDA needs to review and clear these changes in advance. These new guidance documents do not change the FDA's review standard. A new 510K is required when a marketed device has changes, including changes to software, that could significantly affect safety or effectiveness of the device, or when there are major changes in the intended use of the device. Instead, the new policies enhance predictability and consistency for innovators deciding when to submit new 510Ks by better describing the regulatory framework, policies, and practices underlying such a decision. This improved clarity will help lower the barriers to innovation and improve patient care by reducing unnecessary submissions to the FDA for changes that could not significantly affect device safety or effectiveness, so patients can benefit from upgraded products more quickly. Many devices function as tools in the hands of physicians. They benefit from feedback from doctors that helps innovators make small adaptations to improve a device's performance. A regulatory framework that fosters this kind of useful revision is a key to improving their safety and performance. These are just some of the steps we're taking to encourage innovation in medical devices. The FDA will be unveiling additional steps we'll take to improve the path for device innovation while building additional safeguards to ensure the safety and effectiveness of new and existing products. The FDA's effort to promote the creation and regulatory acceptance of development tools also encompasses efforts across the agency's drug programs. With the passage of the 21st Century Cures legislation, the biomarker and clinical outcome assessment qualification programs are now formalized and have the added benefit of key features that will promote the development of these innovative tools for a specified context of use to aid in promoting efficiency in drug development. The legislation emphasizes the importance of partnering with external stakeholders, increases transparency and predictability, and allows for prioritization of products that will have the greatest public health impact. In addition to qualification efforts, a new work stream has been developed to design and validate a series of algorithms as drug development tools that can be used for simulations to predict an outcome such as overall survival once key patient and disease parameters are entered into the model. These approaches can be used for classification of important observations made in clinical trials, such as assessment of tumor growth versus shrinkage. The aim of all these policies is to improve patient access to innovative medical products while continuing to protect those who rely on these products. That was kind of a complicated article, but I thought it had some good, useful information for all of us. Once again, you're listening to Health and You at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Switching gears now, I found some interesting short articles at mayoclinic.org. The first one is about children's health, and it's entitled Halloween Safety, Tips for Trick-or-Treaters. Make Halloween safety part of your holiday fun. Start with these practical Halloween safety tips. It's the time of year for costumes, sweets, and tricks and treats. While Halloween offers plenty of make-believe fun, it also brings real safety risks. As children dart across dark streets with their minds more on candy than on cars, kids are twice as likely to be hit by a car on Halloween than on other nights of the year. Burns and cuts are also common on Halloween. And then there's the candy. Almost two-thirds of parents think their kids eat too much of it around Halloween. Halloween can be safely enjoyed, especially when parents put extra care into planning and supervision. Talk with your children every year about safety concerns unique to this holiday, and review do's and don'ts before heading out to trick or treat. Follow these tips to keep your family safe this spooky season. Carve safely. Before you start carving pumpkins, consider these Halloween safety rules. Decorate with markers, glitter glue, or paint. Let young children draw faces on pumpkins with art supplies. Leave any carving to an adult. Use candles with care. Place candle-lit pumpkins on a sturdy surface away from curtains and other flammable objects. Never leave candle-lit pumpkins unattended. Better yet, light pumpkins with flashlights, battery-operated flameless candles, or glow sticks instead. Get clever with costumes. From furry animals to princesses and superheroes, choosing costumes wisely is an important part of Halloween safety. Follow these tips. The brighter, the better. Whether you buy a costume or make one yourself, choose bright colors and flame-retardant materials. If your child will be trick-or-treating outdoors after dark, attach reflective tape to his or her costume or treat bag. Size it right. In case it's chilly outdoors, make sure your child's costume is loose enough for warm clothing to be worn underneath, but not long enough to cause tripping. Avoid oversized shoes and high heels. Skip the masks. A mask can obstruct your child's vision, especially if it slips out of place. Use kid-friendly, non-toxic makeup instead. Limit accessories. Pointed props such as wands, swords, and knives might pose safety hazards. Carry flashlights or wear glowing wristbands instead. Trick-or-treat with care. Before your children start trick-or-treating, review these basic Halloween safety tips. Get in on the fun. Accompany trick-or-treaters younger than age 12. Pin a piece of paper with your child's name, address, and phone number inside your child's pocket in case you get separated. Encourage older kids to trick-or-treat with a group of friends, parents, or older siblings. Make sure someone in the group has a flashlight with fresh batteries. Set ground rules. If your child will be trick-or-treating without you, plan and discuss a familiar route and set a curfew. Review safety rules, including staying with the group, walking only on the sidewalk, approaching only clearly lit homes, and never going inside a home or car for a treat. Have your child carry a cell phone for the evening so that he or she can contact you. Inspect treats before indulging. Don't let your child snack while he or she is trick-or-treating. Feed your child an early meal before heading out, and inspect the treats before allowing your child to dive in. Discard anything that's not sealed, has torn packaging, or looks questionable. If you have young children, weed out gum, peanuts, hard candies, and other choking hazards. If your child has food allergies, check candy labels carefully. Even hard candies may be manufactured in facilities that process nuts, milk, soy, wheat, egg, or other allergens. Ration the loot. If your child collects gobs of goodies, dole out a few pieces at a time and save the rest. You might even ask your child if he or she would like to swap some or all of the candy for something else, such as a special toy, book, or outing. Plan a party. Consider planning a trick-or-treat party with a couple of neighbors instead of house-to-house door knocking. Decorate the garages, have a costume contest, and plan games and prizes. Check local schools, malls, and churches to find other safe celebration options. Stay safe and sweet on the home front. Planning to hand out treats? To make sure you're ready for trick-or-treaters, follow these tips. Clean up. Put away anything trick-or-treaters could trip over, such as garden hoses, toys, bikes, and lawn decorations. Clear wet leaves, snow, or other debris from the sidewalk. Turn the lights on. Replace any burned-out bulbs to ensure good visibility at the walkway and front door. Control your pets. Take no chances that your pet might be frightened and chase or bite a child at your door. And consider sugar substitutes. Instead of handing out sugar-laden treats, try stickers, fun pencils, rubber insects, or colored chalk. And if you'll be driving on Halloween, watch for children who might pop out between parked cars. Be especially careful entering or leaving driveways and alleys. Extra caution can help ensure Halloween safety for everyone. And I hope everyone out there does have a wonderful and a safe Halloween. Remember that SunSounds is a member-supported service. So until next week, have yourself a happy and healthy week.